today we're going to talk about signs that perimenopause is ending and that you're transitioning into menopause. I'm Dr. Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Mackey from Progress Your Health. So today we don't actually have an actual question. Normally we're, we've had this question a couple of different times. This actually was from a patient, curious about where she is. So signs perimenopause are ending. What would you say about that? There's a lot going on there.
Well, I would say everyone knows what perimenopause is, especially nowadays, and everybody knows what menopause is. And it's not like a line in the sand or when you cross the border, you're from one state to the other. It really, there is a transitional phase between perimenopause, like I said, gliding into menopause, that I feel like that phase, especially women that are in that, which actually is me, because I'm 51 right now and I'm going from perimenopause to menopause, that they kind of get shooed away or pushed into one group or the other.
So what you're saying is that there is, what you're alluding to, and we sort of talked about this the other day, that there's perimenopause, there's menopause, but there's something right in between those two, like a premenopause, not perimenopause, but a premenopause, that sort of, is sort of hard to define sometimes.
Yeah, you can have characteristics of both. Mm-hmm. And so one episode, if anybody watched the previous episode, or I think it might have been two episodes ago, we talked about a listener question wondering, hey, can I take estrogen therapy? I'm still having a period, but I feel like I'm going into menopause. Can I take estrogen therapy? And we kind of wanted to tease that apart because in some ways, yes. And then in some ways, no, you don't want to. So it's like I said, I feel like there's like this group of women that aren't in full perimenopause, but they're not in full menopause. They're in that in-between stage, which is, you think about like puberty. Puberty, you're not in puberty and then you're out of puberty. It's a phase, things are changing. And so that's what I'm feeling is, maybe I'm feeling myself because I'm right there, where I'm right in that in-between stage between perimenopause and menopause.
So we know what the commons, and I'm sure everyone listening, if you're listening to this, you're probably in perimenopause. So what are the common symptoms that most people complain about with perimenopause? And maybe if you feel comfortable, what are you experiencing in perimenopause?
Well, I would say, you have these symptoms and then, as physicians, as doctors, we also do a lot of lab work. We do a lot of testing to help differentiate where somebody is. But in terms of perimenopause, fatigue is probably, especially if anybody Googles this, you'll see fatigue is at the top, low libido. You can have night sweats. Weight gain is a huge one. Irregular periods, heavier periods, missing periods, then having periods, period changes.
Of those common ones, there's some of those you don't have, some of the, which ones of those are you sort of dealing with yourself?
I think I was talking to you about this earlier, maybe a conversation a while back, is like the top five symptoms. There's fatigue is probably the top one. Weight gain is a big one a lot of people complain about. Trouble sleeping is a big one in perimenopause. And then you can also have mood issues. Gosh, there's even more than five. Skin issues, hair issues. The period changes. But I would say for me, I'm not really experiencing any fatigue issues. I feel like my energy is pretty good, but
you're interesting. We're kind of describe ourselves, or I described us as you're like the hare and I'm the tortoise, right? So you're really quick to get things done and gotta go. And I'm a little bit slower to do things, but you kind of putter out fast where I can kind of keep going for a long time.
Yeah.
So you definitely don't. I don't think you really have any energy issues. You just go full bore and then you're done. I wouldn't say that's, I think most people probably like to feel that way because you're very productive and you get a lot of things done. So energy, certainly not. Sleep, you've always sort of had some sort of a sleep issue for the most part, right? So I don't think your sleep's gotten any worse.
No. My whole life I've had sleep issues. Even when I was like 3 years old, my parents would have to lock the door. Otherwise, I'd get out in the middle of the night and, go find things to do because that's just my MO. But I actually do sleep really well. I would say I sleep probably better now that I have when I was in my late 30s, early 40s. I think my late 30s, I slept really poorly. I think I actually sleep pretty good now. I would say for me, it's more the period changes and with the menopausal symptoms, I am having some night sweats. I'm definitely having some of that brain fog.
Night sweats. When do you have night sweats?
I have night sweats. Usually they're about in the middle middle to the later part of my sleep cycle, so more like 2 to 5 in the morning.
It must be pretty mild though.
Oh yeah, mild. They're more, what I notice for me is they're more like my thighs, my torso, maybe a little bit in the back of the neck, but it's not like you think about with menopause. I mean, I've had women, patients come to me and they sleep on blankets, they have ice packs, they change their jammies in the middle of the night. So I will have to say that, you know, I've dealt with...
They got the fan on, they got the window
open, that's right.
They got the AC on.
Everybody's cold.
The house like a meat locker, you know, and they're barely comfortable and everyone else is freezing.
So that's why it's interesting because, you know, you and I have dealt with... hormones. Like I started doing hormone replacement therapy with patients when did we graduate from school? Like 32 or 33. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't menopausal. It was, I wouldn't say it was difficult because as a female, I could relate, but you know, talking to someone about their menopausal symptoms when I'm not anywhere near menopause. So now it's different.
Now you know my situation. I'm not even a woman and I'm trying to do all that. So yeah, at least you're a woman. You can relate to some extent. So It's a challenge for sure.
But it's a little bit of like, you know, it's different. Like the period changes, I'm definitely having the period changes, having the night sweats, but it's like I'm having a little bit of that perimenopausal symptoms and then having a little bit of the menopausal symptoms. So where does that put me in terms of, you know, what would be a good treatment plan moving forward?
Sure. Yeah, well, and that's why that kind of transition within the transition, if you want to call it that, just as the end of perimenopause and beginning of menopause, that's where, and honestly, those tend to be sometimes very challenging situations because they're having, and I think we even alluded to this on the last episode, someone's having a lot of low estrogen symptoms, right? So they sort of seem like a candidate for estrogen, but then you give them estrogen and they'll start bleeding and now you can't continue to do that. So that's why there's no real perfect way to deal with some of those situations. That has to be literally on a case-by-case basis, individual to individual. And sometimes, I hate to say it this way, but sometimes you just kind of hope for the best that you're going to introduce a therapy, you know, estrogen of some sort or, you know, whatever, even progesterone for that matter, and it's actually going to, you know, it's going to benefit them. It's not going to make their situation worse or complicated in some fashion.
Yeah, well, that's probably why they call it the practice of medicine. You're practicing, right? Sure. You're practicing because you're, but I do feel like, you know, when perimenopause, well, let me back up a little bit. So perimenopause, you'll notice that the estrogen drops, but the there's my menopause brain. It is my brain. I will tell you, I used to be really sharp, but
you're still pretty sharp.
Thanks. So in perimenopause, it's the progesterone that drops. Your estrogen can stay the same and it can actually, in perimenopause, can go up or it could go down a little bit, but usually that estrogen stays the same, so that progesterone bottoms out. So that's why you have a lot of those symptoms of waking up in the middle of the night for hours and not being able to go back to sleep, feeling kind of grumpy or you're irritable, you know, your patience is short during the day.
I would say for you, that is really kicking up there.
Oh, really?
Pretty good, yeah. Yeah, you're...
Maybe it's warranted for the situation.
It's always the husband's fault.
Maybe
always.
It's warranted.
Always, always. Well, yeah, well, of course. I'm always wrong. You're always right. So thanks. It's always my fault.
No. But no, I know in perimenopause, we can feel like our patience is short. Even and things that aren't supposed to annoy you or you don't have any control over can be really annoying.
Okay, so what do I do that is really annoying? You can be honest. What do I do that's really annoying?
I can't say off top of my head.
Well, off the camera, you can say a whole bunch of things. So just be honest. What would you say that is? Because I'm sure the things that bother you are the same things that bother all the other women, and they're about their husbands. I would imagine it's sort of like simple stuff, right? Nothing too crazy.
Oh yeah, like you know, drinking your tea, and
the way I swallow.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. And it's not even that.
The way I chew, the way I breathe.
Or if I'm walking, you happen to be in my way. Like, what are you doing in my way?
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Just understanding. Yeah, just understanding.
You sound like, why are you moving me away?
But I get a lot of that feedback. So I get a lot of women telling me those same things, right? And honestly, some of them sort of take it personal. They think there's something wrong with them. They sort of feel guilty about it. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't me. I'm not like this. I never used to behave this way. And all of a sudden, I just can't control myself, or I can't control the outburst, or I can't. Before they would, the way they say it, maybe this feels for you the way it is for you, is that before they could kind of bite their lip or just contain it, mm-hmm. okay, now they don't have the filter anymore and it just has to like sort of come out, or they have some kind of an outburst where before they never did.
Yeah, and that, you know, isn't a lot of women and myself too would be like, that's not really my nature. And then you feel bad and you internalize it and then you get sad and, you know, it's just...
You're mad 1 minute, you're crying the next.
Yeah, because you feel bad. You know, you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings, especially somebody that you love. Is the last thing you want to do is hurt someone's feelings. And you probably get this too with patients, is they will be hurtful to the people around them. And I've done that too. And, but they're super nice to the person at the grocery store. really nice.
You're very nice. You're pretty much nice to everyone except for me sometimes.
I apologize.
I'm just teasing. We're making light of it. But these are significant issues that, which is why we talk about these all the time, because women have a lot of pressure. They have a lot to do. You know, they're working, they're taking care of the kids, they're running the household, they have a lot on their plate. I mean, how many times have a woman told you that they wake up in the night with racing thoughts about their to-do list of all the things they got to get done?
Oh, all the time.
I mean, and that's, you know, specifically from a woman in her mid-40s to her mid-50s, you know, she's just sort of run ragged a little bit. Or they don't have any time for themselves. They don't have any decompression time. They don't have any time to relax. It's just a constant onslaught of, being pulled in multiple directions. And then, they just don't feel as good as they, on paper, life is good, right? But they just don't feel as good as they want to, or they, in some ways, maybe they deserve to feel.
Well, I would consider that not just, I mean, you're talking about perimenopause. Wouldn't you consider that a menopausal symptom also?
Well, of course. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. The women between, their early to mid 40s to their, later, mid to later 50s, I'm assuming as they get closer to 60, maybe they're retiring, or maybe the kids are moving out of the house, or, they become empty nesters. So some of those pressures are start to decrease as they transition into their later 50s.
So would you say that that's hormones or life?
Well, I think that, and we've talked about this many times in the past, I think that the hormones, and same thing for men, hormones give us a buffer to all those things, right? We can handle pretty much anything when we're 25 hormonally. We have probably a lot more stress or a different type of stress when we're 55, but we don't have the hormones to handle it. And now that, completely changed the dynamic. And this is the part about medicine that sort of drives me a little crazy, is that there's not enough attention given towards the impact that hormones have on our body, from a treatment standpoint. Because we're just sort of, this is aging, you're just supposed to deal with it, this is just the way it is. But hormones have a huge impact on how we look and feel on a daily basis. How does that just get marginalized and ignored? That doesn't make any sense to me.
That's why we always talked about perimenopause. People always had treatments for menopause, do some hormone replacement. But perimenopause, it was like, take some antidepressants, take some benzos for your anxiety. Now I know it's different. 2024, things are different. But back, even 10 years ago when we were talking about perimenopause, people didn't even know really what it meant.
Yeah. I'm distracted because I see you. You got a little friend over there.
I've got our poodle here, Vivian. She likes to have constant attention.
It's so ridiculous, but it's still cute though. But I'm trying to talk to you and I see this big black nose down there. So if you ever see a little head popping up from the right table, that's Vivi. Her name is Vivian, but we call her Vivi. So now she's going to keep doing it. So we have a co-host, a third co-host on the thing. Anyways, all right. So I don't know where
we could get her to paw the on and off button.
Yeah. We need another one for run the camera and do the lighting and stuff. Maybe we'll put her to work. Kind of lost my train of thought there because I got distracted by the
signs of perimenopause ending and transitioning into menopause.
Well, like I said, just the fact that in medicine there's not enough attention giving towards it, so people are just forced to. Now, like you said though, when you first got into practice, it was all menopause, right? In the early 2000s, it was all menopause drove the bus big time. In the last 10 years, it's transitioned quite a bit. Now, women of a much younger age are looking for treatment options outside of the conventional landscape, because
I would say when I first got into practice dealing with menopause, I would have perimenopausal women come into me and their practitioners had been treating them like menopausal women.
Yeah, sure.
Saying,
yeah. Well, that still happens today. Yeah, I
know. They tell me my estrogen is nothing. And I'm like, well, did you do your blood draw while you're on your period? Because that's when your estrogen would be nothing. Mm-hmm. Or perimenopause, there's a a hormone, the follicle stimulating hormone, the FSH, and the luteinizing hormone, the LH. Now those do move around throughout the month. If you're prior to ovulation, you'll see that LH jump up, you know. So sometimes doctors will just do an, a lot of times they don't even do the LH, but they'll do the follicle stimulating hormone. And when you're in perimenopause, like your mid to late 40s, your FSH might look like you're menopausal, but you're not. So you might do an FSH because, you know, blood work is just a snap picture in 1 second of your day, of your life. As you do an FSH, it could be really high and the doctor will say, oh, you're in menopause. You're, in fact, you're postmenopausal. Mm-hmm. But then you do the blood work again 2 weeks later, 2 months later, 1 month later, and that FSH is back down.
But they're also having a regular period too.
Yes, yeah. So
you're not in menopause if you're having a regular period. So
that was one thing that I think you and I kind of pushed into was dealing with perimenopause, because you do deal with perimenopause different than menopause. You know, perimenopause, like I was saying, you know, when that progesterone goes down and you're getting grumpy and you're waking up in the middle of the night, and is that, you know, doing some progesterone can just do magic. But once you start to go into menopause, like I think the podcast we did earlier, is when you go into menopause, you can take all the progesterone in the world, but that's not going to help with your hot flashes or help you from having, you know, night sweats waking up in the middle of the night. So that's when you might matriculate into something that might help support the estrogen. But we're kind of, so what you'll see between that perimenopause and that menopause is definitely the hot flashes increase, the night sweats, missing more frequent periods. Like, for example, I didn't have a period. Oh, I have to look back at my little calendar notes, but I think it was like for 3 months. Then I had a period twice a month. And now we'll see what happens this month.
And there's not really much, as a doctor, right? There's not really much you can do about that, really.
It was so nice not to have that period.
I'm sure it was. Especially if you, like you said, before you've had a history of heavier periods, it's probably a nice, convenient situation not have to deal with it at all.
Yeah, it was nice. You know, there's different ways to do hormone treatment, you know, or probably for me at some point I'll go on that rhythmic dosing where you do the estrogen and progesterone throughout that 28-day cycle, which would cause a period, but it would never probably be as heavy as my periods were in the past because it would be balanced.
And that, we're doing it exogenously as opposed to what your body is producing.
So I'll probably eventually matriculate onto that, but I did a, you know, just, you know, because I'm my own experiment, is whether my FSH levels are going up or my estradiol levels are going up, because that's what you would see in that transition from perimenopause to menopause, is that FSH is bouncing around and your estrogen is bouncing around, which is why you're having irregular periods or no periods. Is I did notice when I did take a little bit of Biest, which is that combination of estriol and estradiol, I did a little bit of Biest cream. Now, I always take my progesterone capsules.
So I always ask, what was your, do you mind if you tell them what your milligram amount was?
Oh, yeah, let me get into that. First, I was doing the progesterone 100 milligram sustained release capsule. I've used that for years. I love that. It helps me sleep. It's hopefully good for my mood in the morning. But
I think we might need to increase it. Okay.
No. So that's the milligrams for progesterone.
I'm sure it's me.
But I did do a little bit of some Biest, 1 milligram, which is equal to 0.2 estriol with 0.8 milligrams of estriol. 0.2 estradiol, 0.8 estriol, a total of 1 milligram, transdermally on my inner thigh, and I did feel really good.
Yeah.
I felt really good.
Mood was good. So just 1 milligram actually made a big difference.
But it's too much. I know that you feel like that's too little. I feel like milligram is too much.
I know that it's not, because this is what we're talking about, this, because you're right in the middle of this new zone. Perimenopause, menopause. There's probably someone that's a marketing person out there will come up with some kind of.
Yeah, I'm not creative like that.
Yeah, they'll come up with some kind of a term that is
the mashup.
A mashup between perimenopause and menopause. Now, there technically isn't anything like that, but you're right in the middle where you're talking about rhythmic dosing. You're not, as another doctor that prescribes that on a regular basis, you're not a candidate.
No, I'm not a candidate just for
not yet.
Where my estrogen levels are bouncing around, where my FSH levels are bouncing around. But when I did that 1 milligram of Biest, I felt really good. Like my mood was good. My brain sharpness, because I'm usually pretty quick. Like I know throughout my career, I can look at someone, I can remember their name, I can remember their kids' names, I can remember what school they go to, their kids, I can remember if they went on vacation to Hawaii or if they went to, you know, Thailand. Like I'm pretty good with that memory. But I have noticed probably in the last year that when I'm talking to a patient, sometimes the word doesn't come out very well. And I've talked to that with menopausal women all the time. The word's in here. It just takes an extra microsecond or a minute or 5 minutes to get it out. It's in there. It's not dementia. It's not anything like that. It's in there. I just can't get it out. I've noticed that. But when I did that biased, I felt really sharp. I felt really good. And then I got a period a week later. So I feel like it's on the right path, or that in between, which is kind of that perimenopause, is the ovaries are kind of working. They're not, you know, they're not heading out, you know, they're not out on vacation. They haven't retired, but they're working a little bit. You put that exogenous hormone on top of it, it might be too much. It might be too little.
Pushes it over the edge.
So I think, so for me.
So right there, from my perspective, that would make you right now really not a candidate for really any estrogen quite yet.
Probably, you know, the estriol, you know, I can use that. I use that on my face. That's not really changing anything too systemic. I'm thinking, you know, and that's what I do with my patients. And that's why you said this is a practice of medicine, is we test the blood, we get their symptoms. We start with the less is best. I knew that 1 milligram would be too high for me. I would say maybe, and I was doing a 1 milligram biased. So there was 0.2 milligrams of estradiol and 0.8 milligrams of estriol. That's considered an 80-20 ratio. So probably what might be better is doing more like a 90-10 ratio. So 90% estriol and then 10% estradiol. So, cause it's the estradiol that thickens up that endometrial lining and really causes more of that.
That's
estrogen.
Where you and I were sort of diverging a little bit. Yeah, you're saying 80-20 to 90-10. I'm thinking
it would lower that estradiol. It would raise up estriol.
Why not just do straight estriol then?
Well, I still think when you're in that transition phase, for me, depending on where you're at, is a little bit of estradiol might be beneficial as long as it's not causing too much bleeding or hyperproliferation of the uterine lining. But I was thinking maybe 90-10, and I've done this with a lot of patients and going really a lot lower, like a 90-10, 0.625, 0.375.
Yeah. Well, like I said, this is why this particular transition period for women, and from a doctor's perspective, especially a male's doctor perspective, this situation that you're in and that I'm sure millions of women are in across the country is a really challenging spot because they're in perimenopause, but they have all the symptoms of menopause, but they're not technically like candidates for estrogen yet. Yeah.
And granted, in six months, things are going to be different, right? Yeah. In 6 months, things are going to be different because the body's always changing.
Or it could take another year. Yeah. It could be even longer than that. That's the thing. You really have no idea or an accurate way to predict how long that transition is going to take. And when you become beginning of July right now. Mm-hmm. So let's say you haven't had a period until Christmas. Well, okay, then we know the landscape. Then you're a candidate for a lot more things because now there's been a history of no period for a while. The further you're away from it, the more tolerant you sort of become of using estrogen therapy. That's where most of the time, if I'm going to start a woman on rhythmic dosing per se, I do think starting rhythmic dosing, this is not a push for rhythmic dosing, but if you're going to start it there, it's best being in close proximity of their own menstrual history. So not right after it's over, like the last period, but within a certain amount of time, because their body's used to having a lot of that estrogen there. So now you just sort of continue that same menstrual history, but now we're doing it exogenously through the hormones.
Yeah, so you're restoring those hormones or providing the hormones that the ovaries aren't producing any longer.
Yeah,
so
we haven't done an episode about rhythmic dosing.
We'll talk about that.
Now that we're on YouTube, we'll do one about that fairly soon because that, you know, in some ways it confuses people why you would have a woman in her mid-50s intentionally having a period because normally that's seen as a sort of a bad thing, right? In static dosing, you know, we've had cases over the years, no bleeding in static dosing. We don't want there to be any bleeding of any sort because that is a sign of potential
danger. That's why I stopped the bias because I got a period like a week or 10 days later.
Now, were you expected to get that or is that just out of the blue?
It's just out of the blue. I think the estrogen probably stimulated whatever lining had been there already and because it had been like 3 months since I had a period. So then I did the bias, like I say, it was only like 10 days worth of my, you know, my own experiment and I felt amazing, but then got a period and then I stopped it. I haven't done it since. And then I had like two periods in a month, two periods in second month and this month so far, nothing. So we'll see. Yeah. Like I said, doing the blood work, you know,
how. So now that you had such a, you know, close proximity, now you're going to probably go another 3 months without anything.
So we'll see. And then maybe, you know,
probably test. Won't have one until after Labor Day, probably closer to Halloween.
Oh, we'll have one when we go on that trip to Westport. I know it. That's just how it is. Because that's when I got that other period, was we were in the cabin. We went in the cabin with my parents for Memorial Day.
Oh, yeah. We live in Washington. We went to a place called Marble Mount, which is kind of in the North Cascades, which is a beautiful place. Oh, if you ever get a chance to go, it's beautiful up there. But always, you know, you go on a trip and, you know, if you haven't gotten your period for a while, you go on a trip, you're going to get your period pretty much.
That's like Murphy's Law.
It's like clockwork every time. All right. So we're defining this something, you know, transition period that's not defined. You're sort of right in the middle of it. I will say that this is the more challenging transition, because once you're having the hot flashes, the sleep issues, the night sweats, and no period, then it's really easy, right? Then you're in full-blown menopause, and there's lots of options there. Like I said, static dosing, rhythmic dosing, progesterone, you know, whatever. There's lots of things that can be done. The only thing you can really do in perimenopause is everything except for the estrogen if they're having a regular cycle, or if you add in the estrogen, either one. Because I've had a couple of cases where you give them estriol for vaginal dryness and they start bleeding from that. I've had that a couple of times, not a lot. Suppositories use estriol and started having bleeding shortly thereafter.
Do you think it was because they were going to have their period, or just because the estriol stimulated?
A couple of them were actually in menopausal women.
Really? Wow. Because I haven't really seen much with the estriol causing any uterine thickening or uterine hyperplasia.
Yeah, no. Now, then we just put them on some progesterone and it sort of resolved relatively quickly. That's a debate. That's a whole nother podcast that we've done before. If someone's using estriol vaginally, do you need to put them on progesterone? And I think it sort of depends, right? If they're having bleeding.
I would say the estradiol, you know, in perimenopause, if they're having a period. Now, we haven't really talked about if a patient or a woman isn't taking or doesn't have a uterus. Like, I've had some women that don't have a uterus and they're in their 40s. In fact, I can think of one, and she wanted to know, I think I'm in menopause. I'm in menopause. And she wouldn't know. And I mean, you would know from some of the other symptoms, like the hot flashes, the night sweats, the brain fog, you know, vaginal dryness, pain with intercourse, some of the common symptoms that you're seeing there. But she doesn't have a uterus, so she wasn't having a period.
She's technically in surgical menopause automatically.
Well, no, because she didn't have her ovaries out. She had had a hysterectomy years ago in her 30s. She's in her early 40s.
So
lovely.
So that's called an oophorectomy when they take the ovaries out, right? So hysterectomy, oophorectomy, total hysterectomy. So even though they take the uterus but leave the ovaries, that's still not considered surgical menopause. They have to take the ovaries in order for it to be considered surgical menopause.
Because those ovaries can easily work, like that patient I was just mentioning. I said, no, you aren't in menopause. I just did your hormones. Her FSH is like under 4. And we must have, because you don't know where you are in your cycle when you don't have a uterus, we must have caught her like somewhere after ovulation because her progesterone was just gorgeous. It was up there at like 14 or 16.
Oh, nice.
So, I mean, and she's not taking progesterone. How are you going to make progesterone unless you're making it from the ovaries?
Right.
And her estradiol was great. So I said,
now that is a little unusual though. I mean, that's a pretty good case.
I've had lots of women that have had their uteruses out, but their ovaries keep working for a long time.
Just as many of those that you've had, that have had them out, the other ones that have had their uterus removed and now they have menopausal symptoms within 2 weeks.
Well, I think it depends on the age.
It goes both ways. I think it depends on the woman. I think it goes both ways. Or maybe in some ways the reason why they've had the hysterectomy in the first place.
Yeah.
Because both can happen. 3 weeks, 3 months, or 3 years. Sometimes even longer than that, the symptoms are going to start to show up. Once they have, now you're right, leaving the ovaries versus not is going to dictate everything for the most part. But you can't predict who's going to have the menopausal symptoms early, who's going to have them delayed.
I would say just from experience, women that have had their ovaries left in maybe in their late 30s and early 40s can easily have ovarian function.
Oh, sure. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying it.
But
there's two ends of that spectrum there. Some that go through the symptoms right away the minute the uterus is taken out, and then some, their ovaries are still chugging along and still producing hormone for quite a while.
I will also say that when they do have that uterus out, usually in the first, like, 8 to 12 weeks, you will see a decline in that ovarian function. I don't know if it's just a shock from the surgery or it's not connected or something. And then you'll see that the ovaries
On blood work,
I'll see the ovaries drop down, that FSH goes up, the estrogen, progesterone all die, but it does come back up. Now, that does lead in another interesting thing that we've talked about before. I think we might have talked about it before. I've thought about it, is if a woman is 49, 50, and she needs a hysterectomy, maybe mm-hmm. she's got fibroids, maybe she's got endometriosis, is it a good idea? Because they're pretty close to having menopause at 49, 50. Why don't you take the ovaries out too?
Well, and we've talked about this on a couple of previous ones. I had a patient that was sort of miserable, endometriosis, mid-40s right now, mid-40s, maybe early 40s, before younger than 45. Just have had a really tough menstrual history over her whole life. Even since being a teenager, she's had a tough go of things. And then met with a surgeon. She had an endometrial surgery. She was in her 20s. Now she's in her 40s. Went back to the same surgeon. And I told her, we had a consult before her surgery, says, make sure he takes everything. Okay, mm-hmm. Uterus and ovaries, because the ovaries are not serving. You're not having any more children. You don't want any. You already got two kids. Mm-hmm. You're not having more kids. You'd be better served by them removing both. Well,
because then you could do the hormones. You could restore the hormones. We have something to work with. Yeah.
The surgeon, to his credit, thought he was doing her a favor by leaving her ovaries, and now she's post hysterectomy, and she feels just as bad as she did before the surgery. So. That's a situation, granted, that's just one case, but that's a situation where they should have, they're trying to do the right thing by leaving the ovaries. That's a situation because of the clinical picture in which she was dealing with, which is not necessarily what a surgeon is necessarily concerned with, that's a case where they should have removed it all, total hysterectomy, as opposed to leaving them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do think, there's case-by-case basis on that. So I know we've talked about that.
Yeah. I think that used to be, have you noticed this trend? So I talk to women roughly in their 40s and 50s. Okay. You do too. I'm obviously preaching to the choir here. And you ask them about their menstrual history. When did mom go into menopause? When did mom do this? When did mom do that? Oh, I don't know. She had a hysterectomy early on. Do you run into that a lot?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
Didn't your mom have a hysterectomy? Yeah,
at the age of 28. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it would have been 1974.
Yeah, that generation, a lot of women, because when I first started in practice in 2004, mm-hmm. a lot of the menopausal women I had met actually had, some of them, their parents had hysterectomies. So it was hard to say, when would their mom have gone through menopause because they had a hysterectomy, and they did them a lot more frequently back then. Now it's a little different.
And I think they did total hysterectomies very often.
Total. Exactly. Total hysterectomies. And then in the last, I'd say maybe from the 90s to 2010, 2015, when they would take the ovaries out, the doctor would recommend, take the uterus out, they would recommend to take the ovaries out. And now I'm noticing in the last probably 7 years, maybe seven years, that they're wanting to leave the ovaries in. And I love the premise behind it, because if your ovaries are great and they're pumping out hormones, your hormones are the best hormones in the whole world. Why not promote that? But like you were saying with your patient, is if those ovaries weren't really doing the correct job, if anything, they might have been a hindrance to the system.
Just remove them.
Then it might have been.
Especially if a woman is in her 40s or 50s and she's contemplating a hysterectomy. Ovaries are still a hormone sensitive tissue. The uterus is a hormone sensitive tissue. If you remove them all, you're sort of eliminating some potential risks down the road. So leaving them, especially for women in her late 40s, early 50s, really doesn't, at least in my opinion, I'm not a surgeon, and I haven't looked at enough research to know why this swing back the other way 50 years later. But a lot of times it makes no sense.
But you have to think if somebody didn't have access to hormone therapy, or they, maybe it's more costly if they do both. Everything's so different now. But
I think that it's an intention for the right reasons, but it just never seems clinically to be done the right way.
But if you think about it, how like I said, I was talking about patients that have had hysterectomies in their 30s. There really aren't that many. That women that have hysterectomies.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. But women that have hysterectomies are usually perimenopausal age because of that change between the estrogen and the progesterone, that estrogen's fine, progesterone drops down. So then you have, you know, more issues with fibroids. That's why more women in perimenopause have fibroids than, you know, women that have had, you know, babies in their 20s and they don't have any active fibroids in their 30s, but they get active fibroids in their 40s because they're in perimenopause and because of the hormones in perimenopause. That's when they would have that hysterectomy. Maybe
not even fibroids. They just get a heavier bleeding.
Towards the end.
You would think, logically, you'd think that your periods would, especially if they are heavier, you'd think that it would just kind of get progressively less and less and less.
Well, that is a sign of perimenopause ending, truly. Like I'll just say for myself, and I have other patients like this too, I've always had heavy periods. You know, when I first got my period at camp, and I was 11. It's not fun asking the bunkmate next to me if she had any pads. I mean, I was too embarrassed to go to the nurse, but
11 anyway. At camp.
At camp. Summer at church camp. Yeah.
Church. I was going to say, is it church camp?
Yeah. I might have been horse camp. I went to a few of both. But yeah. So from there, I did have heavier periods. So, but now I've noticed since I hit probably 45, 44. That my periods have gotten a lot lighter, that they're a lot more tolerable. Instead of having to go to the bathroom every hour to make sure that, you know, you're not leaking into a pad, that, you know, I can go hours. So that is one sign that you will see with perimenopause ending going into menopause, is those periods are getting lighter and shorter.
Okay, but did you go through the period, the window of time where it gets heavier and then lighter, or is it just yours were heavier, 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 and now it's lighter, lighter, lighter?
That happened to me where it just went lighter, light. And I think because I've had access and, you know, to hormones, because I deal with hormones, I started taking progesterone a lot earlier, doing things to balance kind of what I would consider that I had most of my life is a very sensitivity to estrogen. So, you know, working on that, you know, reducing down estrogen metabolites, working on the estrogen dominance, working on the progesterone insufficiency. So I've had access to that. So I've been able to balance that, where somebody else that might have been me, because I have a history of endometriosis, of polyps, ovarian cysts, somebody like me might have had a hysterectomy a long time ago.
Yeah. In another decade, in a different time frame.
Or maybe didn't have access to, you know, the knowledge that I know, practitioners. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So your situation, yours has gotten heavier, heavier, lighter, 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 and then you're going to be finishing up fairly soon. Do you think that's more common, or what I said, where it's normal, it gets heavier abruptly, and then it gets lighter?
Oh, yeah, you see that too.
The one, I think the one where it gets really heavy abruptly are the ones that are having the hysterectomies in their
classic perimenopause. That progesterone drops, that estrogen is just coasting along just fine, and what does estrogen like to do? She likes to grow things like the uterine lining. Right. So that's where women will say, oh, I'm having such heavy periods, or they're lasting a lot longer, or I'm having two periods in a month.
That's a whole nother podcast topic right there, but let's say they're 47, they're acutely having some really heavy periods. You can control that with, you know, progesterone or whatever, but why so much of a push for the hysterectomy at that point? Or are sometimes women, depending on the level of the bleeding, they're just sort of tired of it, and it doesn't really make any difference anyways because they're almost in menopause, so you might as well just take it out.
To be honest, at that point, I'll tell people the last thing, if anybody deserves not to have a heavy period anymore, it's that woman that has gone through heavy periods. Sure, so I usually recommend them to go get an ablation. If they don't have any fibroids in there, you can't do an ablation if there's fibroids in there, but an ablation is really nice. And most of the women that have told me that have gotten ablations just say, I wish I had got it sooner.
Yeah,
but at the same time, it reduces their periods, might even not ever have a period with, you know, depending on how they do the ablation, but they still have this other signs and symptoms of hormonal imbalance, or, you know, the perimenopausal hormone imbalance.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so you want to work with that too. That's not going to change how they're feeling, you know, how their sleep is, with their mood, all that kind of stuff. It's not going to touch any of those things. So, do you have anything else to add about?
Well, maybe just to kind of summarize what was the question, and then we kind of went off on lots of really amazing tangents.
I think this is a really hot thing that's all over social media. Women are interested in trying to figure it out. You and I are still trying to figure it out. We've been doing this for a long time. There's still, now granted, we know a lot about it, but at the same time, we're trying to, do our part of understanding and then communicating what we've learned over the years, because I do think that it's difficult, especially you know, especially conventionally, you know, for, you know, even a gynecologist or a primary care trying to deal with a perimenopausal woman, that's not an easy thing to do because they're dealing with blood pressure and cholesterol. And now you got a perimenopausal woman coming in. That doctor doesn't know what to do.
Or even menopause. You know, a lot of doctors, they can't be the jack of all trades. They don't know how to, and they don't necessarily need to know how to do hormone replacement. Yeah. That's why you have to have the.
In 2024, I think hormone replacement has definitely become its own specialty.
Yes, or
it's quickly becoming its own specialty because, you know, you just can't deal with all of it. And honestly, in some ways, hormone replacement therapy for menopause and perimenopause is challenging because there's not one way to do it, mm-hmm. right? I wouldn't say a million, but there's multiple ways to address each type of situation that makes it, for a practitioner standpoint, makes it very challenging because you can't just, you know, look up condition, see a drug or see a couple of options, prescribe the drug. It don't work that way.
Nope.
It did not work that way. So anything else to add about, you know?
Well, like I said, just let's summarize up.
Okay.
All right. Signs, because we write down we talk about. So signs that perimenopause is ending.
Of course, you got to go by the script all the time.
I like to go by the script. I'm very well structured.
Yeah. We don't really script it. We're just
We don't script it. I jot down some chicken scratch and some questions. Yeah, so signs that perimenopause is ending is definitely the hot flashes and the more night sweats. So usually with perimenopause, you'll have the night sweats. Right before your period or even just into your period is when you'll get them. But when you're transitioning into menopause, you'll get more night sweats throughout the entire month. And then when you really go into menopause is when you start to have the daytime hot flashes. So nighttime first, daytime later. Then, of course, the period changes, missing periods, lighter periods, maybe even two periods in a month like I'm having, but they're not super heavy. You'll see that. Mm-hmm. I would say for perimenopause in terms of mood is there is anxiety and irritability. Like that's the hallmark of perimenopause.
I would say that's true.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's true. Especially if your nature is a little bit anxious, it's going to get worse. But I would say with menopause, the mood changes can change more to not so, I would say the irritability kind of dampens down more the worry and the sadness. That's what I see more with menopausal women. They're worried about things they have absolutely no control about, thinking about things in the middle of the night that aren't going to happen. But the worry, you know, that trepidation is there that, you know, people will tell me, and I can say for myself too, like, oh my gosh, I used to be so fearless. You know, why am I so worried? So I would say the worry, and then there is some nostalgia. I'll see some melancholy and more sadness rather than the irritability.
So the perimenopausal women are pissed and the menopausal women are sad.
Yeah. Yeah, and worried.
Okay, all right.
Well, so that's just now, you know, we're just giving umbrella cases. Everybody's different. And I would say for weight gain, both.
Oh yeah, both. Absolutely. Yeah. I honestly, that one is so challenging, right? There's from all the things we're talking about, the sleep, the hormonal changes, the busy lifestyles, the food we have access to, all of those things, weight. Is, you know, that's why, you know, the GLP-1 medications, the injectable medications are so popular right now because not just women, but people in general are just sort of frustrated, right? Because mm-hmm. It seems like no matter what they do, they just can't really seem to make any progress. You know, it's really challenging. And there's a million different people on the internet and talking about how to do it and this and that. And, you know, it's a real big challenge on a weight loss side. So,
and then I would say for the hair, in perimenopause, it's more frizzy. Like I used to have straight hair. And why is it so frizzy? Because that's the change with the with the progesterone and the estrogen. But with menopause, you'll see the hair thickness go down. So in perimenopause, you see more frizzy, maybe a little.
And the volume goes down.
Yeah. With perimenopause, because the progesterone is dropped, that estrogen is still there. Estradiol's chemical structure is almost identical to testosterone.
That's where this came from.
Yes, yeah, that's where our PYH.
From the chemical structure of estradiol.
Mm-hmm. So estradiol, and which will do a testosterone structure, but they're very almost like mirrors to each other. I think there's a carbon group or a hydroxy group that's different. So estrogen can sometimes stimulate testosterone receptors, and then without the progesterone, the testosterone isn't being buffered. So you'll see for women in perimenopause, their hair gets more frizzy, and then they lose more in the temple and the top of the head, where in menopause, you see more, the thickness goes down because the diameter of the pore or the hair follicle gets smaller in diameter. So if it's smaller in diameter because of the less estrogen, then the hair that comes out is thinner. And then because the estrogen and progesterone are both dropped in menopause, the testosterone gets to be the leader of the chain gang. So you see a little bit more of the issues with the androgen type hair loss or more thickness when you're looking at that. For perimenopausal women, they have might get more acne because that testosterone gets to play its little game, and then it causes more acne around like the chin and the jawline. Where in menopause, I don't think you see as much, you know, acne issues.
I think usually by the time, so as that, like kind of where you are, have you noticed an increase in blemishes? Because I know before you used to get one every now and then, but I think your breakouts have actually decreased.
I never really had a lot of breakouts, to be honest.
Well, no, just like an occasional one here or there.
Yeah, you know. I still get one here or there. That's what makeup's for.
Yeah. But there hasn't been an increase.
I would say my skin has gotten a lot better in the last probably couple of years. Maybe it's because we moved from Vegas to Washington. The hydration is really nice and the dryness isn't there. But I was thinking in terms of the bumps or the milia, or I used to get the little milia or whatnot. That's gotten a lot better in the last couple of years. Maybe that's because maybe I need to recheck my testosterone or something.
As you're transitioning, this part you're talking about, you go from perimenopause, you get a drop in the female hormones, progesterone, then estrogen. So the androgens sort of compensate. By the time they're in menopause, that compensation on the androgens has already taken place. So they've already gone through it. They are going to go through a bad skin patch. It's already happened in their later 40s.
Yeah, I think that's
their early to mid 50s.
Part more of, you know, overall for perimenopause. So kind of see that transition there. The sleep for perimenopause, like we said, because that progesterone drops, the cortisol goes up, the GABA goes down, is you tend to wake up for longer periods in the night during perimenopause. But in menopause, it's more the night sweats and the hot flashes.
Yeah, for sure. All right. I think that we've covered this one pretty well. Hopefully we didn't ramble on too much, you know, about perimenopause, but it's interesting. It's, you know, we deal with on a regular basis. If you're watching, you must have your own questions. If you visit our website, progresshealth.com, up at the top, it says, Ask the Doctor, click the tab, enter your name and email, ask whatever question you want. We're on YouTube. So if you're watching this, obviously down below in the comments, you can certainly put your question there. We're a little afraid that once we put these videos out, we're a little afraid of the comment section because I know people can be pretty brutal on YouTube. So we might not be venturing too far down in the comments.
If you do have a comment or a question, go to our website. And on our website, progressyourhealth.com, there's the Ask the Doctor. So a lot of the questions that we do come from Ask the Doctor rather than, I don't know if we'll end up doing a lot of comment questions, but we definitely do Ask the Doctor questions.
Yeah. Just a way to streamline it and just a way to, you know, keep track of, you know, where the questions are coming from. We do appreciate everyone actually writing questions because it's very helpful for us from a content perspective, where it allows us to create a lot of content that is relevant to what everyone's looking for. Mm-hmm. You know, so until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.